Good evening, everyone. Great to have you all coming out here tonight. So we've got John's second talk, which is on the time period between the Old and the New Testaments, which is going to be fascinating as it was last time. So as a bit of an introduction, we'll read from Matthew chapter 2. So with that as an introduction, we'll invite John Ford to speak to us on the time between the Testaments.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Okay, so if you've got your little timeline there that looks similar to that, we will sort of refer to that a little bit. I'm going to spend probably 5 to 10 minutes and do a bit of a whiz through of what we covered last time, because there's a few people here that obviously weren't here last time, and just to sort of then set the scene for what we're going to cover this evening in regards to this time period between the Testaments. So last time we looked at, obviously, this period between the Old and the New Testaments. We looked at when the books of the Bible were written, and we looked at this bit between the... just hang on a moment, let me get my little pointy device here. Okay, yep, we looked at that little bit there between the Testaments of about 430 years. And we identified that the last historical books of the Old Testament were the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they tell us about the exile to Babylon and the return to Jerusalem. And so essentially what we've got is Jerusalem at the end of the Old Testament is in a state of ruin. The priesthood is in disarray. There's no regular temple services. We've essentially got a group of pioneers returning back to Jerusalem, trying to restart and rebuild the temple and re-establish temple worship services. We also looked at Daniel chapter 2 and Nebuchadnezzar's image, which tells us about the four major empires of the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek and Roman empires. And as you can see, they sort of fit in this area of that timeline. And they overlap this period that we're looking at. Cyrus, who was the emperor of Persia at the time, issues a decree that allows the Jewish people to return to Jerusalem and start to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city. Darius, who comes next, who's leader of the Medes, he permits the temple to be rebuilt. And then Artaxerxes, who comes after them, gives Ezra permission to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls of the city. And then along comes the Greek Empire, and Daniel chapter 8 we had a quick look at and looked at the goat and the ram and this transition from the Medo-Persian Empire to the Greek Empire. And the historical books tell us about Alexander the Great and his four generals. So then we went and had a look at Daniel chapter 11, which gives us all of the details of that time period of Alexander the Great. He only rules for 13 years, has a great celebration and drinks himself to death. And the Greek Empire then is split up to his four generals. Those four generals then have battles between themselves, and we end up with the King of the North and the King of the South. And there's over the next 160 years, there's this constant fighting across Israel and Jerusalem. Daniel chapter 11 is very detailed, and it's very accurate. It was prophetical, and it... it's often disputed by some historians because of the accuracy of it. Israel and Jerusalem are stuck in the middle between all of this fighting between the King of the North and the King of the South, and Greek culture starts to influence everybody as well. It becomes very prominent. Greek language, Greek literature, Greek theatre, Greek gods start to be enforced into to the Israelites. Verses 21 to 30 of Daniel 11 tell us about Antiochus Epiphanes and his war with Egypt and how he wins that. And then he sends one of his generals, Apollonius, with 20,000 men to go and destroy Jerusalem. He breaks down the walls of the city again. They set houses on fire. They defile the temple by sacrificing a pig on the altar. And they introduce the Greek idol of Zeus into the temple. Apollonius and Antiochus Epiphanes, they actually try to put an end to Jewish teaching altogether. Jewish sacrifices are forbidden. The Jews are not allowed to even keep the Sabbath holy day. The books of the law and Jewish scriptures are publicly burned, and temples to Greek gods are set up everywhere, and Jews are forced to worship Greek gods. By this time, the Jews have had enough. All this constant fighting across their land, The temple's been ruined again, and they begin to, and they're being forced to worship Greek gods. Verses 33 and 34 of Daniel 11 tell us about the beginning of this uprising of the Maccabeans. And it starts off with Mattathias, a Jewish priest, around 167 BC. He, together with his sons, start this rebellion against the Greeks. Mattathias dies around 166 BC, and Judas Maccabeus, a fairly well-known name, takes over the leadership of the revolt. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us much about this time, so we have to go to other books to identify the history of this period, and Josephus and the Apocrypha are two main sources of information that we look at. Last time we did look at the Apocrypha in a bit of detail there. We looked at when the Apocrypha books were written. They generally accepted that they were written between 200 to 300 BC right through to 100 AD, so over a period of about 300 years. Specifically, we looked at the book of the Maccabees. 1st and 2nd of Maccabees tell us a lot about the history of the Maccabees. And we had a reading from 1st of Maccabees chapter 3. And the books of Maccabees repeatedly stress that the Jews fought above all to defend their holy place and their worship. The temple was the symbol of the whole law for the Maccabees. Verse 2 there tells us that they fought for Israel with a will. They fought with a passion for what they believed in and the right way to worship God. Verse 5 tells us from this that they were violent times. And Judas wonderfully acknowledges that his victories are because God helps him and helps their battles. It's recorded in verses 18 and 19 of chapter 3 there. We don't have that on the screen at the moment. We then looked at Judas Maccabeus a little bit and looked at his victory over Antiochus Epiphanes, his retaking of the temple in Jerusalem, and it becomes an occasion of great celebration for which becomes an annual celebration known as the Feast of Dedication or Hanukkah, as many of us might be familiar with. We had a look at the family tree of the Maccabeans, and the times of the Maccabees after the death of Judas, we saw is called the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, during this time period, there is a lot of influence from the Greeks. That's the main empire at play at the time. The Jewish people are semi-independent from the Greeks at this time, but things are not smooth sailing. And we get to this period here. Sorry, just down a little bit to Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. Hyrcanus II is the high priest, and Aristobulus II is one of the other sort of political leaders at the time. And these eventually make this connection through to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. There's this constant bickering between these two brothers over that period. And unfortunately, they really don't live up to the momentum that was established by Mattathias and Judas Maccabeus early on. The Hasmonean dynasty, as I said, there's a lot of infighting within the Maccabean family. There's a civil war. They fight over the kingship and the priestly roles. And as I said, they eventually form into these parties of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that's essentially where we got to last time. So I'll have a drink and let you all digest all of that. By this stage, the Maccabean family line, they've lost their true faith in their worship to God. They've lost their focus on what the temple is about and what their roles are about. And you know, their roles as priests, they've kind of missed the point on it. During this period, the Sadducees and the Pharisees function primarily as political leaders. So although in the New Testament, when we hear about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, we see them as being more religious leaders, early on when they first form from these two family lines, they're very much political leaders. And we'll see as we go through the studies this evening that that's a big thing at this time period. Everybody's vying for their political leadership role because everybody wants to be better and everybody wants to get better relationships with the Romans as the Roman Empire starts to come in. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about this and what it means. The word Pharisee means separated one. And the Pharisees separated themselves from the body of the Jews when they saw that attempts were being made to influence the Jews by, and I've got this word here, Grecianize, or make everybody more Greek, because the Greek Empire was having such an influence on people. The Pharisees turned to the scriptures and insisted on living in accordance with the scriptures. So the Greeks have come along, they've destroyed the city and the temple and start to influence everybody, and the Pharisees go, oh, no, we really don't want a part of that. We turn to the scriptures and they go, oh, live by the scriptures. The Pharisees also had an oral law, and which was in addition to the written law of the scriptures. And they insisted that people should also observe this oral law. It wasn't written down anywhere, so it became very difficult for people to understand what it was all about and actually follow it. The Pharisees did do a good thing in the way that they actually turned away from the Greek influence. But gradually, they actually became too rigid in the way they applied their understanding of the scriptures to everyday life. Their attitude to people became too rigid. And while they preserved the letter of the law, they completely lost the spirit of it altogether. So they said, follow the scriptures exactly, and that's it. The Sadducees, on the other hand, they accepted the law of Moses. But interestingly enough, they rejected the rest of the Bible, the rest of the Old Testament scriptures at the time. They were involved mostly with the priesthood, but the Sadducees were not a good influence on people. The Sadducees did not believe in a future life. They did not believe in the resurrection. And I always find this interesting. There's an easy way to remember this as to what the Sadducees and the Pharisees believed in. The Pharisees did believe in a future life, the Sadducees didn't. And the way to remember it is, and warning, dad joke coming, the Sadducees didn't believe in life after death, and that made them sad. You see? Boom, boom. So that's how you can remember. The Sadducees don't believe in life after death. So they become completely unscrupulous in their search for power. The Sadducees are looking really to maintain their position of power. They played a very prominent part in the crucifixion and the condemning of the Lord Jesus Christ. So that's where the Sadducees came in. Now, there was also a third religious group at the time that was forming towards this period just before the New Testament starts. And that's this group of the Essenes. And this is partly why we had the reading from Matthew chapter 2. But anyway, we'll get to that. Now, the Essenes seem to have become established around this same time. They're not mentioned in the Bible directly, but Josephus does mention them in this time period. And the Essenes actually put their confidence in the whole of the Old Testament. The Essenes lived a very much quieter life. We do know that the Essenes were involved in preserving the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. And they lived a very disciplined life around keeping the old manuscripts and scriptures. The Essenes were looking for, and what we understand from other historical records, is the Essenes were looking for the coming of Messiah, the coming of Jesus Christ. And the Essenes may well have played a very significant part in influencing other people to look for the coming of Jesus as well. Now, this gets to why we read Matthew chapter 2. There is some speculation, based on reasonably good evidence, but I'll put forward, it is only speculation, that the Essenes were the wise men that came looking for Jesus. Because we know that the Essenes were looking for Jesus, but there's no evidence anywhere to really solidly link it together. So it is only speculation, I might say that. But an interesting thing. So these were the main, they started out as religious leaders, but these were the main they started out as political leaders and then formed into religious leaders and were the main forces at the time of Christ. There were probably other minor religious groups as well. Judas Maccabeus, we know, was very strong and committed in faith, and he maintained the correct worship of God. But by the time of Christ, that has been lost. The groups, these main religious groups, have become very churchy in the way they operate. They've got very regimented rules in the way they like their congregations and their groups of believers to run by. They're very selective and exclusive. There were plenty of religious services going on at the time of Christ, a lot of them led by these groups. But for appearance's sake, they looked good. But there were probably very few religious services run based on real spiritual understanding of what God wanted or what God desires. Most were probably run more like social clubs by the time Jesus comes along. And so a lot of the spiritual side of these groups was lost altogether. Now, at the same time, we've got the political state of the country going through various changes as well. And we know from the prophecy of Daniel and various other historical books, the Roman Empire starts to begin to flex its muscle at this point. Now, before we go into too much detail of the Roman Empire, let's just go back and see where the Roman Empire comes from. And it starts off with the Roman Kingdom around 753 BC. Now, ancient Rome, it's an Italian-based civilization. It began growing on the Italian peninsula as early as we've put there, 753 BC. It's located along the Mediterranean Sea, and it's centred on the city of Rome. It begins to expand and becomes one of the largest empires of the ancient world, as we know. Now, according to the founding myth around the Roman Empire, the city is founded, and I found this was interesting, the city is founded on the 21st of April, 753 BC, if you can believe the accuracy of that. And it is founded by twin brothers, Romulus and Remus. The myth goes on that their mother, Rhea Silvia, became pregnant by Mars, the Roman god of war, and the twins were considered to be half divine. Now, it's fair to say that little is actually known of certainty around the early formation of the Roman kingdom. The records of this, there's virtually no written records of the Roman kingdom and how it formed. Nothing really survived, and the history of the Roman kingdom was written during the time period of the Roman Republic, sometime later. And so they're largely based, the historical records that are written during the Roman Republic are largely based on myths and folk tales and things like this. And so hence why we end up with interesting facts like that, that it started exactly on the 21st of April, 753 BC. Now, eventually the old kings are overthrown and the Roman Republic is then established, as I say, around 509 BC, and it goes right through to 27 BC. Now, you might have in some of your records there that the Roman Empire forms around 67 BC, not 27 BC, and I'll discuss that in a moment as well. During the time of the Roman Republic, the Roman Republic begins to expand quite dramatically. It takes a couple of hundred years for it to really branch out from just the Italian peninsula. It starts to go out through parts of France, across Greece, parts of northern Africa, Iberia, southern France, which I mentioned. A couple more centuries after that, the Roman Republic moves on further, and it moves into all of modern-day France, and then also into the eastern Mediterranean as well. Now, by this time, despite the Roman Republic's traditional and lawful constraints against individuals acquiring permanent political powers, now what that really means is they actually had a law that during the Roman Republic that individuals could not achieve a position of political power and hold on to it for any particular time. But by the end of that time period, there's a small number of people, of Roman leaders, who have these uneasy alliances with various other groups. And it's sort of filled in by various civil wars that occur at the end of the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic was never officially abolished straight outright, and that's why I say there's some debates as to when the Roman Republic ended and when the Roman Empire starts. And there's a few key markers that people mention. Julius Caesar is appointed as the dictator in 44 BC. Mark Antony is defeated at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. And then the Roman Senate grant powers to Octavian under the first settlement around 27 BC. And so there's these various dates that people like to use and say, well, you know, that's the end of the Roman Republic or this type of thing. So we've gone with the very last one, 27 BC, which is when Octavian and adopts this title of Augustus in 27 BC has been the end of the Roman Republic and the beginning of the Roman Empire. And I suppose it's fair to say that although the Roman Empire is just starting at the end, just starting at this time, we know that the Roman Empire has a massive influence right around the world. And many of the things we have in our community today are still based on aspects of the Roman Empire. Now we'll go back and have a look at this family tree of the Maccabeans. So just before the Roman Empire is established, Rome comes and invades Israel. And there's a couple of dubious characters called Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar, names you may well have heard of. And it's at this time, so the Maccabean family at this time, there's this Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. And the Roman leaders, Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar, come in. And they essentially use Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II in a proxy war between Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great. The struggle actually gets a little bit more complex than this. I don't have the name there, but there's an Idumean by the name of Antipater, and there's various other local leaders in Israel and Judea who all try to sway these Roman leaders, Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar. They're all trying to get their leg up in their political status. As I said earlier, there's a lot of this that goes on. There's a lot of backstabbing, bribes, and deceit carries on for years. And essentially, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II get used and abused by Pompey the Great and by Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was a military leader from about 80 BC. He then becomes a political leader from around 70 BC, so it takes him about 10 years before he gets into the political side of things. And then it's not until about 63 BC that he holds a position of a significant authority. And that position of significant authority that Julius Caesar gets to hold onto is called Pontifex Maximus of the Roman religion. Pontifex Maximus is a name that often pops up in various historical things. He is, from 49 BC, the dictator of the Roman Republic. In 63 BC, Judea becomes a protectorate of Rome. And we've got a couple of maps in a little while which we'll look at, and I'll talk about those as to how that works. So Judea comes under the administration of a governor, and Rome then elects a governor and actually makes that governor a king. And it was the governor's business, or the governor's role, to essentially execute Rome's direction on the area or on the land of Judea. And the main thing that they are to execute is taxes, to collect money from people. So how does this sort of play out? Well, Pompey the Great decides that Hyrcanus would be a more acceptable leader for this region. On the other hand, Julius Caesar, he supports Aristobulus, and hence a fight then sort of occurs. And because of the infighting and bickering, believe it or not, Judea actually loses its independence altogether. Aristobulus is taken prisoner and taken back to Rome, and Hyrcanus is reappointed as the high priest, but he has no political authority whatsoever. So they've kind of lost their political status that they were vying for. And as I said, the Maccabean descendants, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, are just being used as pawns by Pompey and by Julius Caesar. A little while later, around 50 BC, Julius Caesar tries to get Aristobulus out of prison in Rome and tries to use his family to then take control of Judea. But there are supporters of Pompey who get wind of this, and then they go and poison Aristobulus and kill him while he's in jail. So that all comes to naught. Pompey's followers, however, have an occasion to turn to the other side as well, and Caesar is assassinated in 44 BC. There is unrest and confusion right across the Roman Empire at this stage because Julius Caesar's gone and people really don't know what's going on. And that unrest flows right back through to Judea and the Middle East. Antipater the Idumean was also assassinated by a rival. And there's a funny little twist here in that although he is assassinated, his family and his supporters identify who assassinates him, and they go and assassinate the assassinator, and then they take over Judea, and then they actually pull Hyrcanus back in, and they use him as a bit of a puppet as well. So it all becomes very much a bit of a mess. And as I say, everybody is just vying for their political leadership role and trying to get their one-up with the Roman leaders. 40 BC, Rome then elects Herod the Great as being the king of the Jews and the leader of Judea in this area. And we'll talk a little bit more about Herod the Great. Let's see, here we go. Here is a list of the Roman emperors from 27 BC. The Roman emperors, the Roman Empire only comes into existence, as I say, from around 27 BC. Although there is about 500 years of the Roman Republic beforehand, the Roman Republic's been quite unstable during this time period. As I said, there's been civil wars. It hasn't had the influence on people. And that's the thing I really want you to look at with the timelines that you've got there, is where the Greek Empire comes in on those little timeline maps. Because it's very much the Greek Empire that has this major influence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. When you think about the time of Jesus Christ, it comes along. What languages is everyone speaking in the New Testament? Kids? Well, Aramaic, yeah. Everyone's speaking Greek, basically. You're right. People, there are some of the sort of traditional Jews speaking, you know, the old Hebrew and Aramaic, but the majority of people in society are speaking Greek. The New Testament's written in Greek as well, as we know. So it's the Greeks that have the major influence. So the Roman Empire is only just starting to flex its muscle in this time period, just before Christ. The Roman Empire is a very autocratic form of government. And the first 2 centuries of the Roman Empire, interestingly enough, were a period of unprecedented stability and prosperity. The Roman Empire grows massively during the first couple of centuries. A couple of hundred years, or actually, during the first century, when the Roman Empire really starts to grow, it reaches its peak by the time we get to Trajan. So he's down the bottom there at 98 AD to 170 AD. Thinking that understanding the Roman Empire starts around 27 BC, we're talking around 150 years. So it takes 150 years for the Roman Empire to really reach its peak. It's another 200 years after this when we then hear about, so around 320 AD, Christianity then becomes the major religion. And that's under Emperor Constantine. And all of this period of the first few centuries is prophesied and detailed in the first 6 seals of Revelation. And obviously we won't go into that too much. And we've sort of moved on a little bit out of the period between the Testaments. So we're just going to wind back a little bit. And really I just wanted to go through that, give you an exposure to the various Roman emperors and how it sort of moves on into the New Testament and into that time period. Coming back into the period just before Christ, when the Roman Empire is just starting out, it's worth thinking about what Roman religion was like. Roman religious beliefs go right back to the beginning of the Roman Empire. Well, before the Roman Empire. Goes back right to the beginning of it. It's going to bug me now. The Roman Kingdom. Right, there we go. Roman Kingdom, Roman Republic. Roman religion goes right back to the beginning. There is, and that's around 800 BC. Now, early Roman religion, which is commonly associated to the Republic, does not really maintain. It doesn't really get much of a hold. And it's not until the Roman Republic comes along that the Romans start to engage with the Greeks that the various Roman religions start to form. And the Romans start to adopt the various Greek cultures. They adopt many of the Greek religious beliefs. They have private and personal worship. So the Romans start to introduce worship, idol worship within their own homes, and have quite sort of regimented processes for how people should be worshipping within their homes and things like this. The two most famous deities for Romans were Jupiter, the god king, and Mars, the god of war. And as the Roman Republic begins to expand and the Roman Empire starts to come in and they start to invade other countries, they then start to actually adopt other religious ideas into their religious beliefs as well, including many philosophical traditions, things like cynicism and stoicism. So that's sort of a little bit of an insight to Roman religion at the time. As I mentioned earlier, the Roman Empire has a very autocratic form of government. Everybody's got their position, and it's very hierarchical. And I titled this slide as being, who's a what, because there's all sorts of different names that we hear about Roman leaders. So we'll start at the top. There's the Roman emperors. They're the sovereign or supreme rulers, and they rule from Rome. Under them is the procurators, and the procurators, their main purpose is to go out and collect taxes. They're essentially the financial affairs people for the Roman Empire. Underneath them, the Roman emperors allocate governors to all of the different regions. And it's important to note that the governors are not always Roman. The Roman leaders were fairly smart with this. They identified local leaders in various provinces that were a part of the Roman Empire, and they nominate those people and put them into a position as a governor. And as I mentioned earlier, Herod the Great is put into a position as, you know, king of the Jews, but essentially Herod the Great is a governor of Judea at the time, or all of Israel, actually. And I won't go through all of these other ones there of Roman authority, because all of these other ones, the ethnarch, the tetrarchs, the toparchs and prefects and legates, they are essentially all just governors in different forms, governing slightly different sized regions and things like this. So we see some of these, the reason I wanted to put that there is because we see some of these names in the New Testament, and we'll hopefully get time to look at those in a little bit too. Now, thinking about Herod the Great, so this is obviously a map of Israel. To begin with, Herod the Great comes from this area of Idumea down the bottom. So as I said, Herod the Great is not Roman. He's a local from the area of Idumea, and he's put into this position. Interesting also to note that the Roman leaders who put the governors in place often manipulated them and put them under, I suppose, sort of blackmailed them in different ways to make sure that the governors carried out their dictatorship from Rome. So Herod the Great, he gets called King of the Jews, and he comes in, he's allocated into this position around 40 BC, and he has control of the whole region to begin with. The reason I've put this up there is all the different colours. This is the time of Christ, so to begin with, Herod the Great is in place as the local governor ruling the whole area. After he dies, his sons and some of his grandchildren take over these different regions, and that's why they're in different colours. So his descendants take over it afterwards at the time of Christ. Generally, Herod's reign is fairly peaceful. There's a few violent outbursts at times, and he reigns up until about 4 BC. So he reigns from 37 BC through to 4 BC. The Jews, however, actually despise Herod. They don't like him at all. And they even have a name for him. They called him an Edomite slave. One, calling him an Edomite, from obviously the area that he came from, and using the word as a slave because they said that he was a slave to Rome and that he didn't really support the Jews in any way. He did have very good relationships with the Roman leaders, and he did his best at making the locals fairly happy with him. One of the interesting facts about Herod the Great is that Josephus records that Herod the Great, and we've got him down the bottom there, is a descendant of the Maccabean family. And he it's not on the diagram there. I wasn't able to find a diagram of it. I probably should draw one up at some stage. But he's a descendant from this Eleazar. And Eleazar Maccabeus has... So Eleazar is the brother of Judas Maccabeus, which we know about. Eleazar has a son, Jason, and then Jason has a son, Antipater the first, and then there's another son, Antipater the second, and Antipater the second has a son, Herod. And that's where the line comes down. So it's quite interesting to think that Herod the Great was actually a descendant of Mattathias Maccabeus as well, given that the early generations of the Maccabeans were so devout towards rejecting the Greeks, the Greek rulers, and establishing true worship. Early in the reign of Herod the Great, he actually tries to establish legitimacy for his role, and he marries Mariamne the First, who is a descendant of Aristobulus the Second. Unfortunately, Mariamne falls out of favour with Herod, and as is often the case with Herod's family, he executes her in some fit of jealousy. and also goes to the next extent of executing both of their children as well. Not a real nice guy. Also, unfortunately, is the last remnants of the Maccabean family are all executed in some way. They're eliminated or put out of their roles. The various male members of the Maccabean family did not live very happy lives under Herod the Great. This is a chart that I got out of a book some time ago, which gives us a good structure of Herod's family and just the mess that they're in. It also gives us some other detail around them. So we've got here Herod the Great. He reigns from 37 BC through to 4 BC, and he dies at the time of Christ. So the reading that we had tonight, where it mentions in Matthew 2, verse 1, in the days of Herod the King, that's Herod the Great. That's this one, essentially the father of this set of this Herod family. He then has quite a few children. Historical records indicate that Herod had at least 10 wives. Here there's only about four of them recorded. And his children are Herod Philip II, Archelaus, Aristobulus, Herod Antipas, Herod Philip I, and Antipater. Herod Antipas is the one that's mentioned at the end of the reading. Did I get that right? Yes. In Matthew chapter 2. Sorry, just checking if that was right there. Sorry, it's Archelaus. Here he is, up here, Archelaus. He's the one that's mentioned at the end. My mistake. What I did want to mention here about, just to give you an example of the mess that the family's in, Herod the Great has these children. Aristobulus, who's not mentioned in the Bible, then has another set of children down here. One of the children of Aristobulus is Herodias. Herodias then marries one of her uncles, Herod Philip I, and has a child, Salome. Salome is the one that dances to Herod Antipas, and Herod Antipas is the one that then puts John the Baptist to death. Herodias then decides she's had enough of Herod Philip I, and she then marries Herod Antipas as well. So the family's really messed up big time, and lots of people getting knocked off around the place as well. So fortunately, time doesn't allow us to delve into the house of Herod too much at this stage, to say that it's not a real nice family. Let's move on. The Herodian dynasty, we can go through this fairly quickly. The Herodian dynasty lasts actually a fairly long time, from 47 BC right through to AD 100. We've got Antipater there, the Idumean, through that period. Then Herod the Great, he's the governor of Galilee, the Tetrarch, and then elected king of all Judea by the Roman Senate around 37 BC. And then his various descendants come after him. And as I said, once he dies, the whole region is split up into these different areas, and his children take over rule of the different areas. And that's where we get this. We hear about things like Herod the Tetrarch, because they're ruling a quarter of what Herod originally ruled. So just got the map there as well. And as I said, just going back, that's what the colours are. And we do hear about some of those within the New Testament as well. Now, here we've got a list of the administrators of Judea coming into the New Testament. So, sorry, there's something I do need to tell you about this. This is quite interesting. So, Herod the Great dies, and one of his children, let me get this right. Can't see it. It must have been. Oh, hang on. One of them ruled only for a short period of time. Herod Archelaus, that's the one. So this guy here. Whoops, Herod Archelaus. So he's the governor of Judea after Herod the Great. Okay, let's go to the map again. So this is Judea, this area here. He's the governor in that area. And quite an interesting story about this, and hence why we read Matthew chapter 2 as well. Archelaus rules Judea really, really badly. Right? He's a useless leader. No one wants to follow him. He just has no idea about running this area. And the Roman leaders in Rome get message from the people of Judea. They actually complain. They go around Archelaus and go to the Roman leaders and they say, this guy's a joke, he can't run the country at all. And the Roman leaders come back and they essentially dethrone him. They kick him out. The reason I wanted to mention that is because in the reading that we had, after Jesus is born and Joseph and Mary take Jesus down to Egypt, when they come back, they get given a message by the angels to not settle in Judea, but instead to go around Judea and go and settle in the Galilee. Now, one, yes, that does fulfill prophecy. Prophecy says that Christ is a Galilean and he comes from Nazareth. But the interesting fact is that had they have settled in Judea, they would have had this useless leader there that had no idea about how to run the country at the time. So it wasn't really the time to go and settle in Judea. So I just found that interesting that one of Herod the Great's children had no idea about how to run the area that he'd inherited afterwards. And then after that time, so as I say, he gets removed at around 6 AD. We then have this list of administrators that come into Judea. And the reason I wanted to put this here is just to give you an idea that not all of these, well, very few of these administrators are actually mentioned in the New Testament. A few of them are. We've got their Pontius Pilate. We hear about him at the time of Christ. And then later on, we do also hear about Felix and Festus. They are mentioned in the scriptures as well. And so we get a bit of an idea of the time periods there. So now that we've sort of covered all that period, I wanted to spend a little bit of time to have a look at, well, you know, the Roman Empire started to come into play. We've got the Roman rulers positioned back in Rome, and they've allocated governors to the lands of Judea and Idumea and so forth. And we do actually read of some of these in the New Testament. Matthew 2, verses 1 to 19, tells us about Herod the Great. Verses 19 to 23 tell us about Herod Archelaus. In the scriptures, it does actually say Archelaus. Often in historical books, they will just say Herod. Everybody in Herod's family was called Herod. And unless they had some differentiation, they were just called Herod. Luke chapter 2, verse 1 tells us about Caesar Augustus. He's mentioned there. Luke chapter 3, verse 1, during the time of John the Baptist, tells us about quite a few of these ones. So look, we might as well turn this one up. Interesting, just to read Luke 3, verse 1. Because normally when you read this, you get quite confused about who all these people are and where they kind of fit in and so forth. So Luke 3 verse 1, it says, "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and of the region of Trachonitis, and Licinius, the tetrarch of Abilene," I think that is. So we've got a few people mentioned there who are a part of this Roman hierarchy. Obviously, the emperor Tiberius, and he reigns from AD 14 through to AD 37. And that's right through that period of Jesus Christ. Pontius Pilate is mentioned there. he's the governor under the control of Tiberius, and Pontius Pilate reigns for AD 26 to AD 36. Interesting fact about Pontius Pilate, he's one of the longest serving governors during the first century. If we flick back to this slide, you'll see that the administrators or the governors of Judea don't last very long at all. And once again, it's because of this constant bickering and fighting. Everybody's trying to get their position and trying to look good to the Roman leaders. Then we've got Herod Antipas. He rules one of the other areas, and Herod Philip II rules one of those other blocks of land. So Emperor Tiberius, he's the main Caesar. Pontius Pilate, Herod Antipas, and Herod Philip are all governors of the regions within Israel. So that's where they sort of come in. And finally, we've got references in Luke 23 to Jesus' trial and the crucifixion, where Caesar Augustus is mentioned, and Jesus is mentioned before Herod as well. So let's have a quick look at that, because I can explain a couple of details there about why it's Caesar Augustus at the time. So Luke 23 and verse 2, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king." Talking about Jesus Christ, they brought him in front of Pilate, and they're saying that he's forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. Now, it's Caesar Augustus. Caesar Augustus reigns, and we've got it at the top of the slide there. Caesar Augustus reigns at this period, 27 BC through to AD 14. And you might go, hang on a minute, that doesn't line up with when Jesus is crucified and when he's taken in front of Pilate. And that's because Caesar Augustus was the Roman ruler that brought in the taxes. He brought in the ruling that says all of the governors and the regions and so forth need to pay taxes. And so it's the locals here who's brought Jesus before Pilate, and they're going, he says that you don't have to pay tribute to Caesar. And they're referring to Caesar Augustus, even though at the time, Caesar Augustus was not the one reigning. So that's who they're referring to, because he was the one who brought in this whole thing about paying taxes. The other people there, obviously, Antipas, where they're further on in verses 7 to 12. As soon as we knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was at Jerusalem. Actually, I'm just trying to find where it refers to. Herod Antipas, that's who they're referring to there. And he rules from 4 BC through to AD 39. And obviously Pontius Pilate, because that's who they're in front of at the time, ruling during that period as well. So I just wanted to include that to give you some idea of where, as the Roman Empire starts to come in and starts to take its influence, that these various Roman leaders are mentioned within the New Testament as well. So perhaps I'll leave it there in respect of time. So I hope that sort of helps fill in some of that gap, that time period. We've got 430 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We had religious darkness to begin with when the Jews are returning to Israel and trying to re-establish the temple. They finally get momentum. The Greeks come along, trash everything again, and then the Greeks have this major influence during that time, during which time the Maccabeans, the Maccabean revolt occurs against the Greeks, and we start to hear about Judas Maccabeus and all those. But over time, the Maccabean family loses their faith and they become more influenced by the world around them. And I think that's the big lesson for us today. When we look at the history of what occurred during this time period between the Old Testament up to the time of Christ, we see people initially
stepping away from the major religious groups and saying that's not the way to worship God, starting to worship God their own way in true faith and the way that God should be worshipped. But unfortunately, over time, they can become influenced by the world around them. And I think that's the key lesson for us as we are in these last days coming towards the return of Christ, because we've had, you know, the last couple of hundred years where as Christadelphians and other major groups who have sort of stepped away from the major religious sects of the world, you know, we need to be careful that we're not becoming influenced by the things of the world around us as well as we come up to the time of Christ. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.